It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
It's Friday. Even better, it's the Friday of a holiday weekend. So I hope you are either going someplace cool or doing the barbecue thing. I guess this is where I usually say media buzz, Sunday morning, 11 Eastern on Fox. So I know you're dying to hear me talk about the debt ceiling negotiations and the Ron DeSantis campaign, and we will get to that. And also those who are predicting doom and gloom for cable TV. But we'll start with this because, you know, it's the spring and it's the weekend, and for as long as she can remember, the stand-up comic Carolyn Bergier has had a recurring nightmare where she's on stage, partly nude, it's scary, and then she wakes up. The difference this time is that she is entirely naked, and this is no dream. Might I pause for a second and say this is a New York Times story, probably one that I wouldn't have expected to read, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. It's real life, or as close as you can get, in a Bushwick, Brooklyn basement. Last month, Bergier, the kind of person who changes in the locker room quickly and discreetly as possible, walked on stage with no clothes on, looked out on a sold-out crowd of 75 people, and realized she had made a big mistake. She forgot to take the hair tie off her wrist. What an oversight. She approached the microphone. She tossed the hair tie to the side and said, "I knew I was overdressed for the occasion." Okay, that's funny. Public speaking is always ranked in polls as among our greatest fears. Stand-up must be worse, but the Naked Comedy Show, it's a monthly showcase, I guess, in Brooklyn. All right, I probably just sold a few tickets for them. I don't go to Starbucks a lot because I'm not a coffee drinker, but sometimes I go in and get a pastry or a sandwich or something. Big news, huge news, according to the Washington Post. I don't quite get my head around it, and it has nothing to do with, well, it has something to do with coffee, but Starbucks has announced that it'll start rolling out new ice machines to make its drinks. Bulky cubes. Who wants bulky cubes? I mean, let's face it. Will now be replaced with nugget ice that is softer and more compressed. The same pellet-shaped ice you can find in hospitals, Chick-fil-A, or Sonic. Starbucks says it will be introducing this ice over the next few years. What kind of news peg is this? The new machines will use less water. That's probably what this is about, save some money. Iced handcrafted drinks make up about 75% of all Starbucks sales. So I guess this is a big deal from a business point of view. And have propelled the coffee giant to record revenue. Here's the statement. Customers who have tried the nugget ice in our handcrafted ice beverages during testing had a resoundingly positive experience. So now there's yet another reason to go to Starbucks. All right, I think this is the point where we roll up our sleeves and clear our throats. All right, that was fake. And get into the substance of what's going on today's podcast. So story number one, the Ron DeSantis campaign. I talked at length. We've all talked at length, and sometimes just with stinging, mocking little headlines, you know, disaster, debacle, the Twitter. You know, I love this. Everything uses the word glitch. A glitch to me, I don't know, I haven't looked it up in the dictionary, is a minor problem. When your entire cast of servers crashes and a candidate, a governor, can't launch his presidential campaign released a half an hour, and then you lose half your runnings, that's more than a glitch. It's a meltdown. But I want to move on from that. And you know, what's interesting to me is I mentioned on yesterday's podcast that I had a chance to join a conference call with Governor DeSantis, where in marked contrast to the Twitter Spaces thing or when he did an interview with Fox News, he was willing to talk about Donald Trump, taking questions from a relative handful of journalists. And he talked about how Trump had run up the debt, the national debt, by $8 trillion in 4 years. Talked about how Trump will drive Democratic turnout if he's the Republican nominee. Talked about some of Trump's attacks on him on issues like immigration. And DeSantis said this is actually helping him because it's helping him draw the contrast. So I rushed the next morning to put up a column about, well, here are some interesting things that DeSantis said on this call, and particularly his willingness to take on Trump. And then I asked a question, and I, you know, is he going to do this in public? Is this, you know, something he's willing to, after so many months of ignoring Trump, turning the other cheek? And DeSantis said on this call, you know, he couldn't be governor and try to get all this conservative legislation done in Florida and fight with Trump and do everything else he had to do. So it's almost like, okay, ready to take the gloves off. And then Politico that afternoon put up a transcript of the call, so other people thought it was newsworthy. And then as I watched some other interviews that DeSantis is doing, he started to, you know, politicians recycle the same lines. I mean, you got to do that, you know, if you're given several speeches a day. You know, you can't assume that the audience has heard what you said before on a certain show, whatever. So DeSantis went out there, and again, Trump added $8 trillion to the debt in 4 years and some of the other similar criticisms. So look, it's policy, it's fair game. All the other Republican candidates seem, with the possible exception of Chris Christie, if he gets in, as it's been suggested he will within days, that they are almost allergic to mentioning Trump's name. Or they use the most indirect, alluding to, you know, people kind of sort of get it with a wink, mild criticism of Trump. You know, you don't win the nomination if you don't go after the front runner. And Trump is over 50% in the polls. These are national polls, yes. Okay, so they have their limitations. And it's early, yes. And that's part of DeSantis's game plan, that up until now, most Republican primary voters, they weren't obsessed with the race, he said on this call. It is early. He also said that most of them aren't on Twitter, so he wasn't expecting to reach them directly. Anyway, here's a New York Times piece. For DeSantis, the immediate challenge appeared to be moving past the rough kickoff and appealing to a mainstream Republican audience. After the discussion with Elon Musk that often strayed into online right-wing grievances and away from the issues voters say they care about most, like the economy. DeSantis defended his position to do the Twitter launch thing. He was on with conservative radio host Eric Erickson. We felt there would be a lot of buzz about it, says Ron, and it probably was the biggest story in the world yesterday. And so hopefully we'll get some people interested in our campaign who may not have been otherwise. We also raised, I think, $2 million so far, but $1 million during the ill-fated Twitter chat with Musk. Didn't look great for Musk either. You know, I mean, he loved it because it's all publicity for Twitter. But is that the kind of publicity that you want? Okay, so DeSantis calls into a New Hampshire radio station. I think a lot of what he, Trump, is doing is showing everybody that he understands that I've got a good chance to beat him because he doesn't criticize anybody else now. It's only me. So look, the scars that I have and the little trickle of blood coming down over here, it's because Trump is afraid of me. Trump has to take me down. And he's got a point. I mean, Donald Trump said nice things about Tim Scott when the senator got in the race. He hasn't particularly beaten up on Nikki Haley. He's still saying, I don't know if I'm going to debate because, you know, he's got this 30 or 40 point lead if you think there is merit to national polls. Back to DeSantis in this interview, Trump wouldn't do that if he didn't think I had a chance. Later in the day, he said Trump was running to the left and that the former president, quote, was a different guy today than when he was running in 2015 and 2016. Well, the world has changed too. DeSantis called into the Clay Travis and Buck Sexton radio show. If elected, he might consider pardoning Trump if he faced federal charges, along with many other people, including defendants charged in connection with January 6th. On day one, I will have folks that will get together and look at these cases who people are victims of weaponization or political targeting. We will be aggressive about issuing pardons. You know, it's interesting. Like, what is the logic behind saying I'll pardon Donald Trump to make people who like Donald Trump personally but think it's time to move on, to let them breathe easy that he won't end up in jail if, in fact, there are more indictments and if, in fact, there are convictions? Interesting tack. I'm sure it wasn't something he just blurted out. Here is Trump calling DeSantis' rollout a disaster. I don't know if it's recoverable. He's very disloyal, and he's got no personality. And if you don't have personality, politics is a very hard business. Well, that's true. And we'll see how DeSantis develops as somebody who needs to be able to connect on a kind of a visceral level, especially with voters in places like New Hampshire and Iowa, where they expect to meet presidential candidates several times before they make up their mind. And they're really smart. I mean, I've covered a lot of those caucuses and primaries. They're really smart and pay attention to the details of the leading candidates. Let's see here. Whit Ayers, longtime Republican pollster, quoted as saying he was appealing to 0.2% of likely Republican voters with that kind of announcement, with DeSantis' announcement. His strategy is on a different dimension than anything I've understood in the past. It sounds like he doesn't really think it was such a good idea, don't you think? Okay, so on the Full Send podcast, Trump says, I'm putting out the COVID numbers. He, DeSantis, didn't do well on COVID. He had more deaths in almost every country in Florida. I hate to say it because Florida is my state, but he did not do well. There's a lot of dispute about that, and a lot of people thought Florida did very well, certainly compared to New York. DeSantis was busy yesterday, called into Glenn Beck and his radio show. And he hit back against this COVID business. I think he did great for 3 years, he said to the former president, but when he turned the country over to Fauci in March of 2020, that destroyed millions of people's lives. In Florida, we were one of the few that stood up, cut against the grain, took incoming fire from media, bureaucracy, the left, even a lot of Republicans, had schools open, preserved businesses. And it was very controversial at the time, where most schools in most states, or certainly most schools in many states, remained open. Remember, this is a time when there was no vaccine and everybody was truly afraid of the coronavirus. And DeSantis went a different way.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Did you know that every major diaper company either financially or vocally supports abortion? If that appalls you and you're looking to support a baby brand that aligns with your pro-life, pro-family views, then Every Life is your solution. Every Life firmly believes that regardless of where someone is from, what they look like, or whether they were planned or unplanned, every baby is a miracle from God worthy of love, protection, and celebration. Every Life offers high-performing, supremely soft, premium diapers and wipes delivered right to your doorstep. Their diapers are crafted without fragrances, dyes, lotions, latex, parabens, or phthalates. And you can feel good knowing that every purchase with Every Life contributes to changing lives through their support of pro-life organizations and pregnancy resource centers. Every Life is not just changing diapers, they're changing lives. Visit everylife.com to learn more. That's everylife.com. And don't forget to use promo code Duffy10 for an exclusive 10% discount on your first order today.
So since we're in the Trump portion of the program, let's go to story two. Bit of a Washington Post scoop here, having to do with Jack Smith's Justice Department investigation of the former president. Two of Donald Trump's employees moved boxes of papers the day before FBI agents and a prosecutor visited the former president's Florida home to retrieve classified documents in response to a subpoena. timing, this is one of those really long newspaper leads, that investigators have come to view as suspicious and an indication of possible obstruction, according to people familiar with the matter. Trump and his aides also allegedly carried out a dress rehearsal for moving sensitive papers even before his office received the May 2022 subpoena. According to people familiar, spoke on condition of anonymity. Prosecutors, in addition, have gathered evidence indicating that Trump at times kept classified documents in his office in a place where they were visible and sometimes showed them to others. Taken together, the new details suggest a greater breadth and specificity to the instances of possible obstruction found by the FBI and Justice Department that have been previously reported. It also broadens the timeline of possible obstruction episodes, a period stretching from the events at Mar-a-Lago before the subpoena to the period after the FBI raid there on August 8th. Now, there were hundreds of classified documents involved, and Washington Post says it's previously reported that boxes were moved out of the storage area after Trump's office received a subpoena. I don't know what this amounts to, but I do think that unlike the sort of more tangled and debatable liability question for everything related to January 6th, it does seem like Jack Smith's investigation of potential obstruction on the classified documents is moving towards some kind of resolution and is gathering more evidence than he had before. This is why Trump's lawyers are suddenly writing to Merrick Garland asking for a meeting. I don't know. I do think, and more important, you know, lawyers and former prosecutors who study this think that it is easier, or potentially is easier, to get a conviction on the classified documents business, because there's no dispute about a lot of the facts, that he took the stuff to Mar-a-Lago. It's government property, despite Trump saying, you know, he could magically or mentally declassify it. The boxes were removed now, according to this story, that even after the subpoena and when Trump and company said that all the documents had been returned, they had not, as the raid showed. A raid that at the time seemed like prosecutorial overreach, but now maybe not so much. Just to circle back to the campaign for a second, here's a Politico piece saying, will this go down as the week the grand plan to deny Donald Trump the nomination fell apart? Well, that sounds pretty definitive, although it does have a question mark. And as you know, in journalism, with a question mark, you can say anything, especially in a headline. For months, high-level Republican lawmakers, donors, strategists eager to block Trump have described to me, meaning Jonathan Martin, an endgame to the presidential primary when it becomes clear in the early polling who has consolidated support. The most influential figures with ties to the lagging candidates will stage a sort of political intervention and tell them it's time to quit and rally to the strongest alternative to Trump. Because obviously, if he's running against five or six people, he's a lock. He's a shoo-in. And that's, you know, you don't need to be a political genius to realize that. Such a plot always struck me as a bit far-fetched, the piece says. For starters, because politicians aren't known for putting party ahead of self, there's an understatement. Yet the appetite among elite Republicans to move past Trump is so immense, I thought there could be at least a do-the-right-thing effort. Yet as spring turns to summer, the vision seems more fantasy than strategy. In fact, if Trump does emerge as the GOP standard bearer, we will look back on this week to grasp why, just like in 2016, he was able to take advantage of a divided opposition. Nobody was more thrilled about DeSantis' decision to begin his campaign on a bulky Twitter stream than his rivals. Trump sees his fellow Floridian as weaker today than at any point since last year's midterm. And the other non-Trumps are hardly going to step aside anytime soon, even though DeSantis has raised a lot of money. And so another interesting point for me as a media watcher, the Politico piece says, DeSantis has earned a lot of bad will from the press. I mean, he can't stand the mainstream media. And mostly he only talks to conservative radio shows, Fox News, you name it. Well, he could take a look at the headlines from a range of outlets. Don't discount this. complain as they may about the media, Republican primary voters are just as susceptible to the tides of coverage as their Democratic counterparts. As for Tim Scott, yes, black Republicans have had boomlets before, but Herman Cain and Ben Carson didn't begin with nearly $22 million in the bank, as Senator Scott has. So that is actually a question that I would like to ask Ron DeSantis if I get the chance, which is, you may not like NBC or CBS or CNN or the New York Times or the Washington Post, you name it. But now that you're an officially declared candidate, will you talk to those outlets as a way of getting your message out? Because to the extent that you think you're screwing them by avoiding them, not granting any interviews, limited access and all that, you also could be limiting your ability to reach a lot more people than were reached on this Twitter stream, even if everything had gone well. It would have been maybe 600,000. I mean, he could have reached more people by talking to a local Florida TV station. So that's a decision that DeSantis is going to have to make. And given that he's in a hole and needs to get more competitive with Trump pretty soon, I think he's going to have to make that decision pretty soon. All right, number three. So this has to do with the debt limit. And I'm going to start out with the latest because, you know, we're getting toward the end of May here. We are running out of time. A little more optimistic headlines. Here's New York Times piece, top White House officials and Republican lawmakers were closing in yesterday on a deal that would raise the debt limit for 2 years while imposing strict caps on discretionary spending not related to the military or veterans for the same period. Officials were racing to cement an agreement in time to avert a federal default that is predicted or projected in just 1 week. Deal taking shape, and this is where, you know, your eyes start to glaze over. But, you know, before I even read this to you, all that was needed for a deal is that each side gets something, can go back to their base and their constituents and say, look, we negotiated right down to the limit, and here's what we got. That's all it ever took. But, you know, with such razor-thin margins on both sides in the House and Senate, that's easier said than done. So the deal would allow Republicans to say they were reducing some federal spending, even as spending on the military and veterans programs would continue to grow. So everybody's against spending when it's stuff they don't care about. And when it's stuff they do care about or their voters care about, then they don't want to cut. And it would allow Democrats to say they had spared most domestic programs from significant cuts. Negotiators from both sides talking into the evening. Here's your daily Kevin McCarthy quote. We've been talking to the White House all day. We've been going back and forth, and it's not easy. It takes a while to make it happen, and we are working hard to make it happen. The compromise would raise the government's borrowing limit for 2 years past the 2024 election, because no one wants to go through this again before the election, according to people familiar. The U.S. actually hit the legal limit. Remember, this is past spending and past borrowing that has to be repaid. $31 trillion, in fact, in January, and has been using sort of accounting gimmicks to avoid defaulting until then. The deal would meet the Republicans' demands to cut some federal spending with the help of accounting maneuvers that would give both sides political cover for an agreement likely to be unpopular with large swaths of their base voters. Here's another point. It would roll back $10 billion of the $80 billion that Congress approved last year for an IRS crackdown on high earners and corporations that evade taxes, though that's still under discussion. So the Democrats can say, hey, you know, we saved $70 billion, and Republicans say, hey, we saved $10 billion in spending that otherwise would have taken place. Now, the more important story, I think, here is captured by a piece in Politico. And it starts by talking about a possible thaw. This is, you know, based on an anecdote from a couple days ago in the debt ceiling fight. Republicans were ready to give Democrats key concessions. And then McCarthy revealed what the concessions were, caps on spending and new work requirements for social safety programs, which the Dems really don't like. This jab upset administration officials. But when pressed to respond to McCarthy, the White House demurred. Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said merely that preventing default is not a concession. It's their job, period. The decision not to engage McCarthy's spin was a purposeful tactic for an administration that has chosen as a media strategy restraint. But here's where they're getting flack from their own party. Administration officials say they want to give Biden room to negotiate, insist they will be rewarded for it, as the public regards them as the adults in the room. They don't need to run to the microphones before and after each negotiating session, as the Republicans do. But the void left by the White House this week, Biden spoke very briefly before Monday's meeting with McCarthy and made fleeting remarks Thursday, has frustrated Capitol Hill Democrats who believe Biden's team is allowing Republicans to define the debt ceiling debate on their terms. Now, before I even go on, this is the overall problem, in my view, with President Biden's leadership. Look, he's been around forever. He knows how to compromise. He knows how to work the Hill. But you don't hear from him that much. And I've mostly framed that as, why doesn't he take more questions from the press? Which is a very valid question. But just imagine the situation was reversed. We're heading for a debt ceiling, for a government default. And Donald Trump was president. He would be speaking every day. He would be saying the same things in different words, but he would be speaking every day. People would viscerally feel, just from something online or seeing a TV news report, that he's on the job, that he's fighting for them, if you're a supporter of Trump, or in this case, Biden. Biden doesn't see it that way. So we don't hear his voice. So virtually every day, McCarthy has spoken. That does let him set the terms of the debate. And, you know, Biden feels like, well, I'll just hang back here when I have news to report or some new attack I want to make, I'll do it. He should be talking every day, and that's not just my opinion. Here's one House Democrat, granted anonymity. It's time to bring the president off the bench or bring somebody off the bench. No one's responding to anything. Kevin's consistently on message. We have the Oval Office. I've never seen anything like it. This person sounds pretty frustrated. Several Democrats yesterday called for Biden to deliver a national address on the state of the debt talks. Amid widespread worry, the White House has not done enough to emphasize the stakes of default. Now, I don't know if a national address would move the needle one bit, but here's a longtime Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro. And Ms. DeLauro says the scale of the cuts is staggering, which really the public knows very little about. The president should be out there. The president should be out there. Here's Congresswoman Veronica Escobar. I do think it's important the president speak on this. And so when members of your own party are saying you're not using the bully puppet, you're not speaking out, the Americans are not hearing from you, you know, I mean, just getting a bland statement from Karine, you know, doesn't cut it. Here's the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, Stephen Horsford, who says they need to use the power of the presidency. I don't buy this argument that silence helps the negotiations. And I just think this is a broader problem for President Biden. He wants to be a low-key president. He wants to lay back. He wants to only speak when he thinks he has something to say. But that's why when people ask, who's a stronger leader, many more people on that question choose Trump rather than Biden. Because, you know, I mean, Biden shuts down on the weekends. I mean, all the things that you've heard and read about. And I think this has brought it to a head, this showdown.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
All right, moving on to story four. The founder of the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes, who was already found guilty in the seditious conspiracy of January 6th, was sentenced yesterday to 18 years in prison. For a second, I thought, wow, that's a really long sentence. And then I thought, well, if you're convicted of seditious conspiracy in an effort to overthrow the government, maybe 18 years is a perfectly appropriate sentence. It's the longest sentence given to any of the hundreds of people found guilty in the Capitol riot. And the judge excoriated Rhodes at sentencing, said, "You, sir, present an ongoing threat and a peril to this country, to the republic, and to the very fabric of our democracy." The judge said he had never expressed such a belief about a defendant in his court. This is Judge Amit Mehta. He described Rhodes as a disturbingly charismatic figure, says the Washington Post, who manipulated dozens of his followers into coming to D.C. on January 6th. Mehta saying they too are victims, victims of the lies, the propaganda, the rhetoric, and ultimately the intention that you conveyed. The moment you are released, you will be prepared to take up arms against your government. So you ain't getting out for nearly two decades. At least that's the sentence. Now, when Rhodes spoke in court, he didn't dispute that he was a key leader in all this. He said he's facing a left-wing plot, including the Biden administration, the media, of course, everybody hates the media, and anti-fascist activists. He said, "I'm a political prisoner. And like President Trump, my only crime is opposing those who are destroying our country." He compared himself to the Soviet dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn and promised that from prison he would expose the criminality of this regime. Well, I'm sorry, you know, you don't get to choose what laws you violate because you think your political opponents are destroying the country. It doesn't work that way. And the guy seems pretty out of touch with reality. And that's why this 18-year sentence, the largest imposed on anybody, but this isn't just anybody. This is the head of the Oath Keepers, other members of which have also been convicted, who had his day in court. All right, let me finish here with number five. So in the Washington Post is a piece that basically said cable news is in a lot of trouble. And look, I mean, that's not a shock in the sense that, you know, the cable news audience is older and it's not clear whether many other people will come along to replace them. But P starts off by talking about 3.3 million viewers watching the Trump town hall on CNN, about a third less than the number of people watching Celebrity Wheel of Fortune on ABC. Declining influence of news. All right, you know, when Trump was president and we had the two impeachments and all of that, it was a surge in interest in news. I mean, lots of, you know, ordinary folks would be talking about it. Not so much since he left office, although obviously he's very much in the news now. So when in 2016, when Trump won the election, just over 70% of all households with a TV had cable or satellite subscriptions. Today, the figure is under 40%. Interesting. "Cable news is dying," wrote Alan Wolk, a veteran advertising exec, "not because it's become irrelevant, but because the medium it lives on, cable TV, is dying." All right, a couple of contrary points. CNN, Fox, MSNBC all enjoyed rating surges when they showcased candidate Trump, negatively or positively, and there's more of that now. What you have to understand about the economics here is that the financial foundation, as this piece points out, of cable news isn't advertising. It's the licensing fees that they charge cable operators for the privilege of carrying their program. I mean, same thing applies to ESPN and other sports channels. Regardless of whether a cable subscriber watches Fox, CNN, or MSNBC, their monthly cable payments help fund those companies. So last year, the licensing fees collected by Fox, CNN, MSNBC, CNBC, Fox Business, and HLN amounted to just over $4 billion, and then advertisers added another $2.6 billion. That's a lot of money, Jack. But the day could soon come when an exodus of cable subscribers leave cable operators unable to afford those hefty license fees. Well, look, everybody has obviously started a streaming channel or an online channel or podcasts or YouTube channels because, you know, you can't stand still. And nobody really knows where this will be 10 years from now and how far the cord cutters, as they're called, will take things. So the Washington Post piece cites Fox Nation as an example, saying if it costs $6 a month Fox Nation subscribers, said to be 1.5 million, strong 2 years ago, so there's no updated figures, generate less than 10% of the $3 billion Fox News collected from cable providers and advertisers last year. I don't think that's so bad. I mean, Fox is making $3 billion, and 10% comes from streaming, and streaming's only going to get bigger. That doesn't sound like a horrible situation to me. CNN's effort at streaming, not so successful. Remember CNN Plus? Of course you don't. It lasted a month before it was shut down. Now, the viewers are still pretty loyal. Primetime audience for Fox, CNN, and MSNBC, according to this piece last year, down just 1% compared with 2012, according to Nielsen. So 2012 was an election year. And now, 10 years later, down just 1%. I mean, cable TV, the cable news, the impact of it on culture, society, sports, politics, has never rested on raw numbers. They've never reached the numbers of the broadcast networks. But because they have such great influence, because they've become the go-to place during campaigns, during conventions, during war, during natural disasters, you name it, people are loyal. Now, will that change? Actually, what's changing is the softer channels are doing much worse. Compared to 10 years ago, I'll close with this. USA Network has lost 75% of its audience. FX has lost 68% of its audience. History Channel is off by 65%. Now, you know why that is, in my humble opinion? Not just because a lot of the programming is not that great. Because people are listening to podcasts. Because people are watching Netflix and Amazon Prime and Apple TV Plus, Apple Plus TV, and Peacock, and what's now called Max, which is HBO. They have a lot more competition than 10 years ago, and they weren't able to keep up their audiences. But as for news channels, and obviously CNN and MSNBC in particular have dropped a lot since Trump left the stage. Of course, now he's back on the stage, so it's hard to put that all that on a graph. But I think this is a useful debate to have, but I'm not as pessimistic as this Washington Post piece about the future of cable news. Maybe I'm wrong, or maybe by the time it happens, I won't be on the air to worry about it. In any event, Memorial Day weekend. Hope you have a good time. Media buzz on Sunday morning. Memorial Day, Monday, I'm going to take the day off, just like most of you. So I'll see you back here Tuesday with more BuzzMeter. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.